Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record Program 344, titled Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Broadcast 1. Subtitle, This is no drill, this is a real attack. This is being recorded on January 20th of the year 2002. This program and the next program are going to consist of analysis as well as further exposition of the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th, 2001. For the purposes of intellectual understanding and conceptualization, as well as for time considerations, we're going to be dividing this analysis and exposition into two parts. However, it is important to understand that as real as the conceptualization is, in a sense it is artificial in that the events of September 11th as regards to foreign policy and military matters, and in regard to political and economic considerations here at home as well as abroad, the distinction is an artificial one. As Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz observed, war is the continuation of politics or diplomacy by other means. Also, the link between economics and political matters and matters military is a profound one, and that line of analysis goes all the way back to Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War. What we're going to be looking at in this broadcast are the implications of the September 11th attack for foreign policy. And the September 11th attack could be understood as in fact an act of war, which of course it was, and in my opinion, and it is a considered opinion, the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th constitutes a continuation of the Second World War. It is both an attack on Pearl Harbor, conceptually, and a Reichstag fire. The difference between the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, and the attack on the Pentagon and the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, is that on December 7th of 41, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was in the White House, and on September 11th, 2001, the Underground Reich was in the White House, and that is a fundamental difference. In this broadcast, we're going to be taking a look at some of the foreign policy and military considerations of the attacks. These are, as I said, inextricably linked with the political and economic considerations and the domestic ones. In For the Record 345, we're going to be taking a look at the domestic considerations. We're going to begin today's analysis with a look at the Financial Times of January 12th and 13th of 2002, the weekend edition. This article is by Gwen Robinson in Washington. It's headlined, CIA Ignored Warning, unquote, on Al-Qaeda, subtitled Allegations in Book. This deals with a book that is being published and authored by Robert Baer, B-A-E-R, who's a former case officer in the CIA's Directorate of Operations. The book is called See No Evil. It is to be published later in January. Skipping down of this book, we read, among fresh details are an account of how, after he left the CIA in 1997 and became a consultant in Beirut, Mr. Baer was advising a prince in a Gulf royal family. A military associate of the prince, he said, had last year warned Mr. Baer that a, quote, spectacular terrorist operation, unquote, was being planned and would take place shortly. Mr. Baer said he also provided him a computer record of hundreds, unquote, of secret Al-Qaeda operatives in the Gulf region, many in Saudi Arabia. Mr. Baer said that in August of 2001, at the military officer's request, he offered the list to the Saudi Arabian government, but an aide to the Saudi defense minister, Prince Sultan, refused to look at the list or to pass them, the names, on. On the Al-Qaeda cell in the Gulf state, which is not named in the book, Mr. Baer claims the two men who led the cell, Shawki Islambouli and Khalid Shaikh Mohammed, escaped arrest and settled in Prague. The information Mr. Baer gave to the CIA was not followed up, he said. In the book, Mr. Baer also claims that in 1996, Osama bin Laden established a strategic alliance with Iran to coordinate terrorist attacks against the United States. By the way, I would add that this is being denied by Iran. One of the things that we're going to look at in this broadcast is what I believe is the role of the underground Reich, quite literally, a Third Reich gone underground, in uniting various elements in the Islamic and Arab world, including elements that have in the past been not only fiercely but lethally opposed, such as the Sunni and Shiite factions, represented by, among others, respectively, the Saudis and the Iranians, as well as some of the Islamic and secular Middle Eastern regimes, such as the Iraqi and the Syrian regimes, both of which could be described as Arabo-fascist, in many ways an extension in the Middle East of National Socialism, but they are fiercely secular and have at times been murderously opposed to some of the Islamists in their own culture, in their own country, I should say. I would also note that Yasser Arafat's PLO, bankrolled by Saudi Arabia, and having both in the person of Haj Amin al-Husseini, himself a major in the SS, and Arafat himself, a protege of SS Colonel and Commando Extraordinaire Otto Skorzeny, the PLO is a secular organization by heritage, and also SS and fascist by heritage, and yet the PLO is becoming, and the Palestinian cause is becoming a cause célèbre for the Islamic fundamentalists around the world. The Saudis bankroll the PLO, or have in the past, despite the fact that the Saudi elite views the Palestinians as contemptuous second only to the Israelis. We're going to be looking at what I believe is the role of the underground Reich in uniting Sunni, Shiite, and secular Arab and Islamic elements in what is not only, from a foreign policy standpoint, an Islamo-fascist and underground Reich-controlled entity designed to annihilate Israel, even more importantly, from a geopolitical standpoint, drive the United States and Britain out of the Middle East and to gain control of the petroleum reserves in the Middle East and also in the former Soviet Union. In this regard, Al-Qaeda and its related Islamo-fascist elements could be viewed as sort of Africa Corps 2, or in the case of the former Soviet Union, Army Group South, Part 2, Army Group South being commanded by Fedor von Bock, and that split off from von Paulus's 6th Army in an attempt to capture the Volga and the Caucasus oil-producing regions in World War II. Now, one of the uniting elements in the September 11th event, as it applies to foreign policy and to the military attack on the United States, and I believe that this is a real war, as real as the Second World War, an extension of the Second World War, and as was the case in the Second World War, with powerful elements of the American political and economic elite sympathizing with fascism and playing both sides of the fence. In World War II, the Bush family, George Herbert Walker, and his son-in-law, Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather, respectively, of George W., were working with Nazi finance, as we've seen in many programs in the past. And the petroleum industry and American finance and heavy industry also very cynically backed the United States when the war began, despite the fact that they had actively aided our enemies. I also want to point out that even though the fascist powers of Europe in particular, and also to a somewhat lesser extent Japan, received pivotal economic aid from the American power elite, at the same time, that war was a very real war. The sacrifices and dedication of the American military forces was very real and very necessary. And even though the political follow-up to the war was in many ways cynical and has led, I believe, to a triumph of fascism, the battlefield commitment is nonetheless very, very real, and people should not be deceived about this war. Even after this war, whatever the outcome, the corporations are going to survive. But many of the people, including quite possibly yours truly and those of you in the audience, may not. Hence, this is a war that is important to understand, important to fight, and important to win. And yet, as we will see in For the Record 345, it is very important not to let this war become a Reichstag fire in addition to a Pearl Harbor, for it is certainly the latter, and it may become the former. This broadcast, again, is called This Is No Drill, This Is a Real Attack. That alarm was sounded by one of the American naval officers at Pearl Harbor. In the next broadcast, that program is going to be subtitled, We Have Ways of Making You Talk. It is to be hoped that this, in addition to a Pearl Harbor, does not become a Reichstag fire. That, in the end, will be up to you and others. We're going to take a look now at petroleum and Saudi Arabia, two elements that unite the Bush family, the Third Reich in its above-ground and underground phases, and also the Umdama, the field soldiers of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, with the Elders of Oil, as I have called them in For the Record 334 and 337. The bin Laden family, very close historically to the House of Saud and King Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi state, in turn very closely associated with the Third Reich and Alan Dulles. The petroleum industry uniting the Bush family and the power elite of Saudi Arabia, including the bin Laden family, who, through Arbusto Energy, James R. Bath, and the Carlyle Group, have economic connections to the milieu of the Bush family. These connections are representative of the profound area of intersection between the economic and political power elite of the United States and of Saudi Arabia and that of the underground Reich. Now, of the synthesis of domestic and economic and foreign policy with regard to the petroleum industry, Saudi Arabia, the Bush family, the Bush administration, and al-Qaeda, we're going to use as a door to begin the examination an article that appeared in the New York Times, actually an op-ed column of Wednesday, January 2nd of 2002. This is a column by Thomas L. Friedman. It's titled, Let's Roll. It reads in part, All hail to President Bush for how he has conducted the war against Osama bin Laden. Mr. Bush has emerged a far better commander-in-chief than anyone predicted. In the war on terrorism, he has shown steely resolve, imagination, leadership, and creativity. Thank you, Mr. Bush. I would add that is Thomas Friedman's opinion. I do not concur, but I do support the war. Continuing. And now, I wish Al Gore were president. Why? Quite simply, because instead of showing resolve, imagination, leadership, and creativity on the domestic front, Mr. Bush has done just the opposite. He has tried to use the tremendous upsurge in patriotism, bipartisanship, and voluntarism triggered by the tragedy of September 11th to drive a narrow, right-wing agenda from September 10th into a September 12th world. It's wrong. It won't work. It sells the country short, and it will ultimately sell the Bush presidency short. I have no problem with nation-building in Afghanistan, but what I'm really interested in is nation-building in America, using the power of September 11th to make our country stronger, safer, and a better global citizen in the world of September 12th, beginning with how we use energy. But so far, all that's happening is that we've made the world safer for Saudi Arabia and OPEC to raise oil prices again. In case you missed it, last Friday the Saudi-led cartel cut production by 6.5% to boost oil prices, while the world is struggling to get out of a recession induced in part by the terrorism of Osama bin Laden and 15 Saudi hijackers. Frankly, the thought that U.S. taxpayers who have had to bail out the airline industry, which was devastated by September 11th and by higher gas prices, and to finance the $1 billion a month war against bin Laden, will now have to pay more for oil because the Middle East regimes we're protecting want to hike the price, is an outrage. I think that there are a number of important points to consider here. First of all, the actions by Osama bin Laden, who, as we've seen, is not in fact, in past broadcasts, is not in fact divorced from the Saudi regime. He is plausibly deniable. But Prince Turki, the Saudi chief of intelligence, who resigned the week before the attacks, and the petroleum-related factions of our own intelligence system have in the past supported Osama bin Laden, and I believe that that in turn has opened up a door, a vista, so to speak, a window of vulnerability which the underground Reich, using Osama bin Laden and the fifth column in the United States, has used to attack the United States. I believe that the activities that have taken place abroad, literally an attack on the U.S., a second Pearl Harbor, the narrow right-wing agenda that is being realized, at least attempted to be put into effect by George Bush in a domestic sense, and the concept of nation building are in fact inextricably linked here. I believe that in fact, as we will see in the next broadcast, nation building in the United States is one of the things that is taking place here through the September 11th attacks, hence my conceptualization of it as a second Reichstag fire. It is also a second Pearl Harbor, and understanding the profound link between political and military matters, as explained by Karl von Clausewitz, and the link between political and economic matters, as noted by many, and between economic and military matters, consider the following. Now, note that Osama bin Laden could be considered, as I've said in the past, sort of the foot soldiers, the plausibly deniable Islamic fascist commando of the anti-Semitic and pro-fascist Saudi regime. Consider Osama bin Laden's latest missive. This reportage comes from the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, December 28th of 2001. This article is by Tarek Issawi of the Associated Press. It's headlined, U.S. Economy is Bin Laden Target. Video appeals to Islamic youth to continue the war at Stateline Dubai of the United Arab Emirates, and it reads in part as follows. The new videotape from the world's most wanted man was broadcast yesterday, with Osama bin Laden calling for the destruction of the U.S. economy as the surest way to bring down America. Looking gaunt but smiling occasionally, the terrorist leader appeared in front of a brown cloth dressed in military fatigues. Although he appeared to be thinner than in past tapes, his voice was strong and clear. He spoke deliberately, often leaning into the camera. Quote, I concentrate on the importance of continuing holy war actions against America, militarily and economically, and America is retreating with God's help, he said in a videotape sent anonymously by Air Courier from Pakistan to Qatar-based Al Jazeera Television, which broadcasted in full last night. Quote, This economic hemorrhaging continues until today but requires more blows, unquote, said bin Laden. In an apparent appeal to Muslim youths, bin Laden repeatedly referred to the 19 hijackers who carried out the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as martyrs. He said they, quote, struck deep in the heart of America's economy, unquote. Still more about bin Laden's call to war in order to destroy the American economy. San Jose Mercury News from the same day, December 28th of 2001, had the following story about the same address. This is by Seth Borenstein and Jody Enda of the Mercury News Washington Bureau. It's Stateline Washington headlined, Experts say tape suggests bin Laden may be seriously ill. Skipping down. On the tape, bin Laden appeared to call for further attacks against the United States, particularly targeting the economy. Quote, We say that the end of the United States is imminent, whether bin Laden or his followers are alive or dead, for the awakening of the Muslim Ummah, unquote, or nation, again quoting, has occurred, he said, according to Reuters News Service, again quoting, It is important to hit the economy of the United States, quote, which is the base of its military power. If the economy is hit, they will become preoccupied, unquote. Now, note, that's what Osama bin Laden is calling for. At the same time, the Saudi regime, as noted in the Thomas Friedman column, is raising oil prices, which is going to, that's right, hit the U.S. economy further. What we're going to look at next is a section from a book that we're going to be dealing with at greater length later in the broadcast and that we dealt with at considerable length last week. A very important recent book authored by Richard Labeviere, L-A-B-E, accent aigu, V-I-E, accent grave, R-E. It's titled Dollars for Terror, The United States and Islam, and it's translated by Martin Demers, published in soft cover by Algora Publishing. It was originally published in 1999 by Édition Bernard Grasset, and it was published in the United States by Algora Publishing, copyright 2000, ISBN number 891-892941-06-6. And in this book, there's description of the Muslim Brotherhood, or the fraternity, as the author describes it. This organization, in turn, is detailed as having, among other things, a fascist heritage, and in many ways, an Islamo-fascist political agenda. The Muslim Brotherhood denies any involvement with either Osama bin Laden and international terrorism. The author in this book alleges differently. Beyond that, he alleges strong connections between the Saudi elite and the Muslim Brotherhood or the fraternity. And one of the points that he makes here is that the Muslim Brotherhood sees economic means as a very important way to carry on the jihad or holy war. This is completely coincident with not only what Osama bin Laden said, but what in effect the Saudi government has done by raising oil prices at this particular time. Turning to Dollars for Terror, under Mustafa Mashour's guidance, the fraternity's economic apparatus pursues the same goal as the military apparatus, the obligatory reunification of the Muslim community. In this economic view, the believers will no longer be brought together by overtly political or insurrectionary means, but by means of the none too easily controlled financial transactions. Since religion is not to be separated from the economy, the various financial practices will have to conform with Islamic law in order to constitute an economically autonomous system of exchanges. Islamic finance, the extension of the holy war by other means. And again, von Clausewitz redux there. Now, considering further the concept of Islamo-fascism as it applies to Osama bin Laden, to an attack on the United States, a goal of destroying the United States and or subjugating it, and in particular driving it out of the Middle East, we're going to turn to an article that was published in the Los Angeles Times of Monday, December 31st of 2001, an article by David Lamb, datelined Peshawar, Pakistan. It's headlined, "For Muslims, Bin Laden's star is fading as quickly as it rose." I would add that is the writer's opinion. It remains to be seen whether that actually happens. But what the writer is talking about here is the longing on the part of many of the impoverished and disadvantaged people within the Islamic world and the Arabic world in particular for a restoration of Islamic glory, and in turn that restoration of the caliphate, or as the Ottoman Empire was known, is something of a mystical slash political concept. We'll talk about that later. The author writes about bin Laden, "He believed that Islam was pure and that the West was spiritually crippled. He was part mullah, part soldier, and to those who think all wisdom is in the Quran and who consider the slate of world history a blank before the Prophet's birth 1400 years ago, he seemed wise, courageous, and invincible." Skipping down. And talking about the deflated and just demoralized feeling of people in the Islamic world, "At least in part, that deflation stems from a feeling shared by many that they are members of largely failed societies in which Islamic unity has been only a dream. More than 1 million Muslims died in the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. By at least one estimate, 75% of the world's refugees today are Muslims fleeing Muslim countries. On top of that, oil did not bring prosperity. War with Israel brought neither victory nor peace, and political reforms sweeping the world from Latin America to Africa did not bring democracy to the Islamic nation." Unquote. Once again, the golden age of Islam seems tantalizingly distant. And skipping down still further, quote, Islam became politicized, and when religions are politicized, that's dangerous, unquote, historian Khaja Masood said in Islamabad, again quoting, but our real problem is economic. Our societies are in crisis. They're illiterate, impoverished, and jobless. That makes it easy for religious leaders to exploit people at the bottom. It enables fascism to come out of the closet. What we're seeing here is that fascism wears religious cloaks, unquote. And I would note that as the Nazis scapegoated the Jews for their economic problems or for Germany's economic problems, so too Israel, a country of 5 million people with no oil, and the Israeli right, which has a fascist heritage, is a separate subject that we're going to be dealing with in part next week. But Israel has no oil. There are 5 million Jews in Israel. There are 1.5 billion Muslims, and there is no social or economic justice to speak of in any of the Islamic countries. None of those are controlled in any size, shape, form, or manner by Jews, let alone Israelis. And yet, we're seeing a scapegoating of the very real problems of the Islamic world as being attributable to Israel. That is classic fascism. What we're going to be examining in the second half of the broadcast is, among other things, the geopolitics, which was in many ways formulated for German purposes by Karl Haushofer, and in turn the fascist third position conceptualization of Islam as not only a vehicle for the triumph of fascism in Greater Germany, but also as a way of negating the concept of the decline of the West, as Oswald Spengler spoke of it. In the second half of the program, we're going to take a look at the links between geopolitics, between Ahmed Huber of Al-Taqwa, whose assets were frozen by the Bush administration. We're going to take a look at a French theoretician, François Bourgat, who is an Islamist, so to speak. And we're going to take a look at operational links between some of the attorneys involved in defending Al-Qaeda members and the fascist third position. And we're going to take a look at corporate links between IG Farben, Standard Oil, Saudi Arabia, and the world of Islamofascism that we're talking about here, as well as the overlapping world of petrofascism. I've alluded to other programs that are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. You can see a detailed and annotated description of For the Record Program 344 on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. WFMU is archiving these programs at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, and all of the back For the Record programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL that is linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and mutually linked to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. That concludes Side A of For the Record Program number 344. Pearl Harbor meets the Reichstag fire. This is no drill. This is a real attack. This is being recorded on January 20th of the year 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.